Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS-FM and WETS-HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, every summer I have the privilege and the honor and the great pleasure of teaching at the University of Tennessee's College of Law. And while I'm there, I meet lots of interesting people. I meet interesting students. I meet interesting colleagues. And this last summer, I spent some time with both. The student was a young lady named Anna Swift. And Anna was a very engaged student in my constitutional law class. She sat right up front and she always had good questions and always did the reading, exactly the sort of student one wants in a law class. And of course, she had interests other than constitutional law. And one of her great interests is public service or pro bono work, and particularly having to do with a clinic that she was in, run by one of my colleagues at Tennessee. His name is Dean Rivkin. Now, I already knew Dean, but Dean and I had never really talked too much about him being on the show. But Anna told me that there was a very interesting issue that had lots of constitutional implications, and the issue was truancy. And I looked at Anna and I said, "You mean you want to do a show about playing hooky?" And she looked shocked at me. She said, "It's not that at all. It's not just playing hooky." Dean said the same thing to me later. He said, "That's the wrong narrative. This is not about Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn going down to the swimming hole instead of going to school. This is a very serious issue." In fact, he said, "Truancy is the first part of a pipeline that leads some students to leave school and end up in jail." And so I sat down with Anna and I sat down with Dean and we talked about it. And by golly, they were right. And truancy, it turns out, presents some interesting constitutional issues.
Well, after a series of letters that go to the parents, the school system makes a determination whether to file a petition with the juvenile court, which has jurisdiction over these cases in Tennessee and throughout the country. Juvenile and family courts are hearing these cases. The interesting thing about truancy cases is that they are called status offense cases. In Tennessee, mm-hmm. they're called unruly cases. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to make the distinction between status offense cases, which are only, quote, crimes or offenses because the juvenile is under age, under 18, as opposed to delinquency offenses, which mm-hmm. are crimes. If an adult commits a burglary and a juvenile commits a burglary, it's a delinquency offense.
So this is a status offense. And right. So how does the kid actually get brought before a court? I mean, right. If he's not being arrested, what, does he get a summons or a ticket or something?
For the most part, it's a summons. In some states, it's called a ticket. Mm-hmm. But in Tennessee, there is a summons, or at least there's supposed to be a summons, that is based on a petition that is filed. One of our initial realizations was that the school system itself was filing and signing these school petitions. Ultimately, we're responsible for testifying in court, and at least here in Knox County for a long time, the school personnel also became the probation officers when students were adjudicated as truant.
So I'm a school principal. I notice my attendance person says, you know, little Johnny hasn't been coming. We do whatever we do just administratively to check up on Johnny. When it comes clear to us that we think he's simply being truant, we send out a summons or a notice or a ticket or something. And then supposedly we go to court and little Johnny shows up. We hope he shows up. He might not. I mean, if he's a truant kid, he might be truant from court, too.
They show up.
Okay, they do show up. Well, that's interesting. Sure. And then we go to the judge and we say, little Johnny's been truant, and we want you to do what? What does the judge at that point do?
Well, this is where the rubber meets the road.
Okay, now we're down to it. Okay.
Right. What a judge should do under these circumstances is put the state, the attorney general's office, the DA, prosecutor, is in truancy court, and the juveniles don't have a right to counsel in Tennessee.
So little Johnny shows up, and he's just there.
Johnny shows up. He's there with a mom, dad, or both. They're not familiar with the legal system.
Right.
They don't understand exactly what the process is. That's uniformly true. They are essentially adjudicated by the judge. What should the judge do? The first thing the judge should do is ensure that that Johnny understands his or her rights in this process, because the consequences of an adjudication for truancy can be quite severe. It can include incarceration, which we are claiming is not a legal punishment.
Well, hold on just a second now. So little Johnny is being brought in because he's gotten a ticket for being truant. And
petition, right?
Okay, and his petition, and there he is in court, and potentially the judge could order him to jail?
Potentially the judge can't order him to jail, but we have, through diligent investigation of records, discovered that Johnny's are being jailed.
So judges are actually doing that?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so he's saying, okay, off to the slammer with you, young Johnny. And yet,
well, the slammer is the juvenile detention facility.
The juvenile detention center, okay.
Right.
But, I mean, it's still a detention facility.
Oh, yes.
And you just told me that little Johnny doesn't have a right to a lawyer?
Correct.
Okay, there's something called the Sixth Amendment, right? Doesn't the Sixth Amendment guarantee a right to counsel, at least in most proceedings? Certainly if you're going to be put in jail, right?
It's more the 14th Amendment in this
right. Okay,
setting.
You're correcting it's me, because that's the 14th applies the Sixth to the states. Thank you for pointing that out.
No, it's not the Sixth. At all, because...
Well, for heaven's sake, isn't that your right to counsel?
The right to counsel doesn't attach except to delinquent offenses in Tennessee, because delinquent offenses carry incarceration as a permissible punishment or disposition.
Right.
Status offense cases, because it's not, don't carry a right to counsel. And a judge who is going to order a kid in a status offense case into the detention center for 24 hours or for 7 days or what have you, isn't going to appoint counsel. Does Johnny have a right to counsel before that happens? Theoretically, we think yes.
Okay, that's what it was coming down to, is that the way that Tennessee's been doing it, these status offenses don't result in jail time. Or supposedly they don't.
And in many cases, they don't.
Okay, and therefore, we don't have a Sixth Amendment issue. Except then, if reality is that judges actually are imposing jail time for these so-called status offenses, then the Sixth Amendment should apply, and he should have a right to counsel. And in fact, I hear a trumpet blowing somewhere, Gideon's trumpet perhaps somewhere.
Well, this
there.
Is more Galt's trumpet.
Okay, Galt's trumpet, okay. But it's the same idea, right?
It's the same idea.
Okay, and that's really the crux of it, isn't it? You all think that they should have a right to counsel if there's a potential of incarceration.
And in fact, we followed very closely a case from the state of Washington that raised a claim of right to counsel in these cases in a system that was very similar to Tennessee's system, a truancy juvenile system. And the lawyers who brought that case won at a court of appeals level a ruling that students did have a right to counsel because the consequences, which included in those cases also short-term incarceration and other consequences that affected liberty interests of the student. Unfortunately, the Washington Supreme Court reversed that decision from the Washington Court of Appeals in a 3-2 decision and found that due process did not require that a right to counsel.
So we were watching that case very carefully.
Watching it carefully. And
now, let's be clear. You're in Tennessee, and so a decision by the Supreme Court of the state of Washington is not going to be binding on you. And yet lawyers always look for similar facts, similar cases from other states, especially in the areas where the law is developing.
Correct.
And they're looking to see what another state's done, and they're always hoping this other state will do in their state what you want to do in your state. But Washington State let you down.
They did. And as you know, it's the persuasiveness of the decision rather than its binding nature that we're looking for when we're trying to make law.
Right.
And
have any other courts or any other states considered this precise issue?
There haven't been any other cases. And one of the reasons is that that truancy is not populated by lawyers very much. There are some states where there are right to counsel. Where students do get attorneys, but for the most part, That's not the case. And even in those states where counsel is appointed, these cases are not treated with the kind of aggressive representation that one would.
I was about to say, Dean,
one
I'm just
would want to bring to them.
I'm just thinking. Should bring them. Obviously, we care about our children, and obviously, it's very easy. I know that you care about these issues very much, and these are very important issues. And yet, from a cynical viewpoint, I don't know if a lawyer could make a dime on any of these cases. Could he or she? I mean, lawyers just don't practice in this area because they're not going to make any money.
You're right. Mm-hmm. Truancy court is a poor person's court.
Right.
Families with means find ways to secure alternative educational services and settings for their mm-hmm. children. So this is a poor person's court. This is one of the reasons why one of the aspects of our practicum, one project that Anna has been working on, is what we call an access to justice project mm-hmm. To develop a pro bono programs where lawyers would, as part of their pro bono obligations, take a truancy case. And Anna can talk about that aspect because it's a really important aspect and it meets your question.
Okay, Anna, tell us all about this. How are you going to address this issue, this justice issue in truancy court?
Well, if you don't mind, before I discuss our Juvenile Access to Justice project, I just wanted to emphasize or elaborate on a couple of the points that Professor
Absolutely.
Rivkin made. So the first one is, as Professor Rivkin said, there is no right to counsel for students charged with truancy in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. But more than that, there's really no easy way at all for these students to obtain counsel. And that's because, I mean, first of all, a student, they can't go ask for a contingency fee basis for a lawyer, you know, because they're defendants and there's no money for a lawyer to make.
Right, right.
And then also the legal aid services here in the state, they don't handle juvenile cases.
Oh, boy.
You know, so that would be a wonderful...
Is that just a classic case of legal aid being underfunded, or is it simply that legal aid is not given the charge to handle these cases?
No, I think it's funding is largely the case. And it's not just the legal aid programs. It's also the public defender programs. Mm-hmm. They have experienced significant and have always been underfunded. And they have to make choices, and they represent juveniles in delinquency cases. They yeah. have to. There's a right to counsel there. Here, there's not a right to counsel. Public defenders are representing adults, and there's more and more adults, parents, who are being prosecuted for contributing to the unruly behavior of their children through truancy. More of that.
So it's not just little Johnny. It's Johnny's mommy
or
daddy
be.
Who could be hauled into. Oh, man.
It can be. But you ask the question whether lawyers can do something about it. Lawyers can do something about it. There are lots of justifications, as I mentioned before, that can be developed. And Anna can first talk about bringing lawyers to the process.
We interrupted you, but you just jump right back in. You got to learn to be aggressive here. You're sitting between two old lawyers, and we just jump in. You got to jump in, too.
So when it comes down to it, these students who are charged with truancy, they either don't have a lawyer or they have to be able to afford a lawyer, which, as Professor Rivkin mentioned, this is sort of a poor person's court, the truancy court, and most, if not all, of these students cannot afford a lawyer by any means. So that's the first point. The second point is that most of these students do end up just pleading guilty. You know, they get brought in front of the juvenile court judge. The judge says, okay, student, do you plead guilty or not guilty? The student ends up saying guilty, and it makes complete sense, because if the student pleads not guilty, then that student has to put on a trial. The student has to put on a trial in front of the judge. The student has to bring forth witnesses for him or herself. The student has to cross-examine the state's witnesses, and that is just way too much for a student to have to handle.
What's the problem?
They have no experience.
I'm sorry.
I thought that was a serious question.
No, I'm being facetious. When I was in high school, and I'm by no means from a deprived background, but I didn't have money for gas for the car, and I would have had no idea how to defend myself in one of those proceedings. So I imagine mm-hmm. most of the kids just come in, and they're utterly intimidated, and they just say,
absolutely.
You're lying. Yeah, I wasn't there.
An important point to make that Anna makes in a little different way is, in Tennessee, the state the DA has the burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence
in these truancy proceedings
to prove that, one, the student has habitual absences, and two, more importantly, that those absences are without justification. It's the state that has to prove that initially.
The state has to prove, and then probably can prove with the records, that the kid hasn't been there.
Correct.
Okay, that part of it's not hard. But then it's the state's burden to prove that there was no justification.
Exactly.
Well, tell you what, I'll take that case. All a lawyer has to advise a kid is to stand up there and say, no contest, Your Honor. No contest. Simply say nothing. I plead not guilty and then sit down. Because then the burden's entirely on the state. The kid doesn't have to lie. The kid just basically says, not guilty, sit down, and now the burden's on you, state. And I'm betting those prosecutors have nothing to offer other than the records.
They potentially have the school social workers who appear in juvenile court on these cases to present as witnesses. But in 4 years of doing this work and doing this representation, we haven't seen one case where the state has had to meet its burden of proof, has had to put those witnesses on. And that's one of the real dynamics of a system where the families are poor. The kids often have issues relating to mental health or health, as I said before. Right. They've missed school. That's true. So they're not necessarily, you know, up to the achievement level that that one might expect. The deck is stacked.
Stacked against them, yeah. And let's just be very clear on this one. Most of the kids there might be tempted to offer justifications. But what we're saying is that, legally speaking, they have no requirement of offering those justifications. It is actually the opposite. The prosecutor has the burden of proving that there are no justifications.
That's correct.
So that's why I said that a person could simply sit down and shut up and would win the case, theoretically, unless the prosecutor had some very specific evidence that he or she could offer. Now, I had a related question. Does a defendant in truancy court have a Fifth Amendment right to say, I'm not going to answer your questions, Judge?
Well,
I'm not going to tell you why I wasn't there or whether I was there.
Sure. Would it be a wise thing for a student, you know?
No, but just it might not be strategically. It might not be a good thing to say. But if I were advising such a student, I wonder if I would say, just, you know, plead not guilty. And if you're asked a question by the judge, say, Judge, on, you know, advice of counsel, I'm not going to say anything that might tend to incriminate me. Now, I realize that that typically is designed to keep you from being convicted of a crime. And so, again, we get back to that issue. Is this a criminal proceeding or is it more in the nature of an administrative proceeding? So I don't know whether the Fifth Amendment right would attach or not.
It's an open question.
Okay.
It is not a criminal proceeding. It's not an administrative proceeding either. It's something
In the middle.
In between,
there.
Right.
All right. So there we are.
So why would lawyers...
Okay, back to Anna. You got to jump in here.
Come into the process.
Yeah.
So going back to why a student would plead guilty, another reason would be if a student pleads not guilty, that means the student has to come back to truancy court. And in probably a lot of these cases, the reason why the student was truant in the first place was because of transportation issues. And so if the student finds out from the judge that pleading not guilty means a trial, which means coming back to court, the student may just give up and say, oh, I don't want to deal with this. I'm just going to plead guilty, not realizing at all what the consequences of that action would be.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with one of my students from the University of Tennessee College of Law. Her name is Anna Swift. And I'm also speaking with one of my colleagues at Tennessee. His name is Dean Rivkin, and we're talking all about the constitutional issues with truancy. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz. In fact, we'll have our first quiz with our brand new quiz guy. And then after that quiz, we'll come back and speak more with Anna and Dean. Stick around.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell. The cook in the lunchroom's ready to sell.
Well, Doug Smith, welcome to your debut as the quiz guy.
How you doing, Stuart?
I am doing very, very well. I'm still a little bit weepy and sniffly over the loss of the quiz lady, but I don't know. I think maybe I can reconcile myself to your presence instead of hers.
I'm humbled by that comment. Thank you.
Well, of course, it still remains to be seen whether the listeners will accept you. So essentially what I'm telling you is you're on probation here.
It's not the first time, and don't let the cops know that I'm out of town.
Tremendous. Well, Doug, just for the benefit of our listeners who may or may not have heard some of your other interviews on the show in the past, could you just tell us who you are and what you do?
Sure. Well, thank you, Stuart. My name is Doug Smith, and I'm the vice president for the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution here at James Madison's Montpelier in beautiful Orange, Virginia.
Mm-hmm. And what do you do in that capacity as vice president?
Well, one of the things I do is I work with some amazing people, some colleagues at the Center for the Constitution. We are really one of America's premier constitutional training centers, working with adult professionals. And we have online courses. We do residential programming and courses as well. And it's all about the values and the philosophies behind the U.S. Constitution. And so we work with teachers and cops and elected officials, and heaven knows our elected officials certainly need a little constitutional training from time to time.
Indeed, they
do. And really anyone who's interested in delving deeper into James Madison, the philosophies of the founders, and really what's at heart here in this phenomenal, important document, the U.S. Constitution.
Yes, indeed. And you've got a long history in nonprofits all over the world, actually, I happen to know. But you also have a particular interest in the Constitution, don't you?
I do. For me, the Constitution is really about civic engagement. You know, we want people to know from where we came and how we have structured our government and how government should function and can function and will function, because it's about civic engagement. I want people to be involved in their own government. And I want people really to think that they own this great country of ours. And the best way to do that is really using the Constitution to remind us that's exactly what the founders had envisioned.
Yes, indeed it is. And one of the best way to engage people, of course, is to quiz them, which is why we have our quiz. And before we get into a quiz, and we will have one here in just a moment, how do you see the quiz? How is the quiz going to change, if at all, now that you're going to be the quiz guy?
Well, you know, we have lots of delicious quizzes in the hopper. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that we'll do from time to time is we'll actually have riddles.
Riddles?
Well.
Riddles? What do you mean by riddles?
There's nothing quite as exciting for any of us who lived through the Batman years as the Riddler.
And you're going to be the Riddler from time to time, are you?
Riddlers are just quizzes with eloquence.
Well said, sir. Well said. And well, do we have a traditional quiz today, or do we have one of these riddles that we're talking about?
Well, we're going to start off with a traditional quiz. We're gonna take your caller a little. We're gonna take a little easy on your caller today, and we'll see how it goes.
Okay. Well, before we go any further, do we have a contestant on the line?
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do. Well, who are you, contestant?
All right, my name is Sheikh Afzal. I'm from Philadelphia.
Sheikh Afzal from Philadelphia. And are you ready to be the inaugural contestant for the new quiz guy?
I'm ready to go. He says delicious, so let's hope how delicious that is.
Okay, Doug, make it delicious.
Well, it won't be as delicious as a Philly's cheesesteak, but I think it's a pretty good question.
I see.
You can ask me where that place is. I can tell you that. That can be a quiz question.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I will ask you, which is your favorite cheesesteak place in Philadelphia?
Oh, my favorite place is Gino's.
You are the man. Gino's is the best. All right. As far as I'm concerned, you already have one T-shirt coming, but now we have to go to the constitutional quiz.
Okay.
All right. Here it comes, Stuart. Sheikh, are you ready?
Yes.
How old do you have to be in the Senate?
What?
What age do you have to be in the U.S. Senate?
Oh, my gosh. Are you going to give him some answer choices, or is he just going to have to come up with a number?
Sure. I'll give you some answer choices. 18, 21, or 29.
Wow. 18. So A is 18, B is 21, and C is 29 years old. Good grief. Well, Sheikh, do you have any idea?
So let's walk through 18. I know 18 is tempting. I'm between 18 and 21. Let me think here. 18 is the vote. I would go with the 21.
You think 21 is a good age for that? What's your thinking process there? Why not 18 or why not 29?
Because I never came across with anything saying 29, but I know I did read some many things about 18 and 21. I know 18 is the right to vote, and 21 is also the right to drink.
Okay.
Shake, how about if we gave you a fourth opportunity, a fourth answer, and said 30? Would that make you feel better?
Fourth choice, make it 30?
30?
Well, since that was not in the option first, so I think that's not the right answer. So, it's the fourth answer. So we have 18, 21, 29, and 30.
Mm-hmm.
I know the president has to be 35, so I don't know where he gets these numbers from. But,
you got to pick one of them, Shake.
All right, I think I would stick with in the Senate. You got to be pretty much, I would say 29, because you probably cannot even graduate from school by the time, because going to college, getting a bachelor's degree, and get some education by the time.
Well, wait a second. Back in 1787, they didn't have all those fancy school things most people were going to. So, well, I don't know. You go ahead and make your choice.
I think I'm going to stick with the same answer. You know, they always say first choice is always the best choice, which is 21. So let's stick with 21 then, I guess.
Doug?
All right. Well, this was a trick question, of course. The answer is 30.
Ah.
But you could be 29 when you were elected to the Senate. In fact, that's happened several times over the course of the Senate. For quite a while, the Senate didn't obey its own rules. And so there were actually several senators who were in the Senate who were not even of age. But the Constitution clearly lays out age 30. Interestingly, in the 1930s, there was a senator who was elected to the Senate at age 29. And he had to wait actually until June the next year when he turned age 30 to actually take the oath.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you have to be 30 when you take the oath.
Exactly. So you can win the seat at 29, but technically you're not able to take the oath until you're 30.
Well, I know what the first big difference is between the quiz guy and the quiz lady, and that is that the quiz guy has much harder quizzes.
That's for sure. You know what? I read the Constitution. I didn't read anywhere it says 29 and 30, but
I see.
Well, learn something new, right?
Actually, it is. Actually, Article 1 does say 30 for United States senators. So I knew. In fact, that was what kind of flummoxed me at the beginning. I was thinking to myself, well, where's the 30 answer choice? And that's why Doug added it toward the end there. But no, his answer is technically correct. You can be elected when you're 29, but you have to wait till you're 30 to be signed in. But that's a very, very tough question.
It is a tough question. And, you know, interestingly, though, Rush Holt Sr. was the
from New Jersey.
Was elected to the Senate when he was 29. He was the senator that had to wait until the June to when he was sworn in. And now I believe it's his son who's now running for the Senate. So it's interesting how these dynasties in America works.
It is very interesting. Yeah, Rush Holt Jr. is the one who's from New Jersey. Actually, he's from Princeton, New Jersey, and I don't think he's going to win. I think didn't Cory Booker just, well, anyway, we're getting into too much of a political discussion, but fascinating question, interesting answer, but you already have a T-shirt, Shake, just for answering correctly on the cheesesteak question.
So, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for taking our quiz.
No problem. Thank you so much. Thank you, Doug.
And Doug, thank you. Thank you for posing such a tough question and for coming on the show. We're looking forward to hearing riddles in the future. We're looking forward to some quiz answer questions that maybe we can actually answer.
Hey, well, you know, I always like to throw a little kicker there at the end just for you, Stuart.
Well, thanks very much, Doug Smith of the Center for the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. And we're looking forward to the next time you're on the show.
Great. Thanks, Stuart.
Thanks. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with one of my students at the University of Tennessee College of Law. Her name is Anna Swift, and we're talking about truancy, and we're talking about what happens to kids when they're pulled into truancy court, and the fact that maybe they need a little bit of representation when that happens.
So that's the situation we've been encountering here, and that's what motivated our Juvenile Access to Justice Project. And the mission of this project is really just to fill this need, to fill this widening gap of students charged with truancy who need legal counsel. And what we really want to do to fill that need is to assemble a panel of pro bono lawyers.
Before we get there, if I may interrupt you this time, Anna, specifically, what typically happens if a kid comes in and says guilty? What happens? What are you concerned about preventing?
A lot happens. Mm-hmm. And as Anna said, virtually every student who is accused of truancy winds up pleading guilty to truancy.
Right.
So then what happens? A handful are incarcerated improperly.
Okay, not good.
Short term, the notion being that some shocking punishment like that would get the kid to school. Of course, no studies that have ever been done show that there's a correlation between that type of punishment or any type of punishment and securing and engaging a kid back in school. What else happens? Students typically get a probation order, okay? And the probation order has various conditions. Too many, we believe and are asserting, consistent with the law of Tennessee. The first condition, which is a proper condition of probation, is typically you must go to school every day without fail from now on. Of course, for a student who has missed 20, 30, 40 days of school for whatever variety of reasons that don't come out in the courtroom, that condition of probation is virtually violated within a day or a week or 2 weeks, because it's inconceivable that without proper assistance and representation and voice for that student's not going to miss another day.
It kind of reminds me of the old criticism of Nancy Reagan. You know, her answer to drug abuse was just say no, and this seems to be sort of a just say yes. You know, you're being brought here because you haven't gone to school, so what I'm going to do is order you to go to school, and that's going to solve the problem.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Also, students are ordered into various character programs, character building programs. Mm-hmm. One in particular here in Knoxville is called Moral Combat.
Moral Combat.
Moral
sounds like
combat.
A video game.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that these programs have value for some of the students, but It's an open question as to whether there is lasting value. The real important aspect of these cases, and this is where lawyers come in, is to go back to the school system, which has the expertise and the resources, and today, in today's climate, the incentive to keep kids in school, and develop a program for that student that will engage him or her and or will look toward an alternative exit from school that makes sense for the student. For example, GED program.
Right. Now, before we get there and what we might do better, let me just play devil's advocate. Set aside the issue of the relatively few who are going to get put in jail, because I can very clearly see why, you know, you would want to prevent that and how that could really be counterproductive. But the other thing, being told you must go to school or you must also go to this program that's going to, you know, build your character. Speaking not as a lawyer now, but just as a member of society, as a parent, I'm tempted to say, well, what's the harm there? I mean, why are you so concerned that a judge might tell a kid, go to school and go to this character building program? Why should we be providing lawyers that might prevent that from happening?
It's like your Nancy Reagan analogy. Mm-hmm. Telling somebody to say no to drugs is one thing. Ensuring that it happens is another. And that's the problem with these probation conditions. They come out of the blue, if you want to look at it that way, without any backup kind of support to get the student to go to school, without any kind of transportation to the program, for example. And it costs money for the family to send the student to the program, without any evidence that the program is going to make a difference for this student, without any understanding of mental health issues, and mental health issues pervade truancy. They pervade juvenile court.
Okay, so you're not so much worried about the terrible thing that might happen to them in truancy court, but setting aside the issue of jail. But the probation and the programs aren't so much of a bad idea. It sounds to me what you're concerned about is that this is
ineffective.
It's ineffective. It's useless. And it allows us to tell ourselves that we're doing something for these kids when, in fact, we're not doing really much of anything for them. But I want to finish one other aspect before we get onto what you want us to do for these kids. What happens if a kid comes in and he gets the probation and then he violates the probation?
Right.
Is he going to go to jail at that point?
Possibly,
mm-hmm.
Although we don't think that's legal either under Tennessee
right.
law.
I understand that, but I mean, the worst case for a kid, other than being sent to jail inappropriately, what happens to him? I mean, the second or third or fourth time he comes before a truancy judge and he keeps violating probation, what's going to happen to him?
What happens typically is, first of all, there are these recursive court appearances. I don't mean to use a fancy word. It's a merry-go-round. Kid
right.
comes to court, 3 months later is back in court, 3-4 months later. The kid is typically, called on the carpet to, by the judge, which is okay for some kids, and for other kids, isn't a terribly pleasant experience.
Yeah. I think I can make an argument for you. I think the argument would be that you're treating these kids very similarly to criminals, even if you don't incarcerate them, and that all you're really doing with this merry-go-round going into court is just alienating them and punishing them in the sense right. of calling them on the carpet. I don't think I would enjoy that. Even the kid who laughs his way through it and seems to be the most incorrigible is probably not enjoying himself.
We've seen very few juveniles in this setting, happy or laughing or defiant. For the most part, they're depressed, they're silent. They don't have or feel the space to say, I was bullied. One of our first cases was a girl who was being raped by an adult.
Ouch.
And she and the school knew about this because there was a DCS, a child welfare worker, who came to the school to investigate a complaint made by this child's mother. So they knew that this was happening.
She was being raped by somebody at the school?
Wasn't in school, no. But
she was
involved.
Somebody she knew from school?
Right. No.
Oh, okay.
It was another adult.
Okay.
But
she was traumatized.
The point is, right, the trauma, the impact, the PTSD.
Uh-huh.
And that had to be met. That had to be understood. That had to be dealt with. And there's no way that a court can deal with that.
Okay. So now we've identified what's happening to these kids, why it's at the very least not good for them, why it's potentially very bad for them, why they need representation to make sure these bad things, at least the worst of the bad things, don't happen to them. Now I think we're getting to what you really are interested in. What should we be doing for them? And what is your position and what are the programs
you all
are coming up with?
I'll let Anna tell you about the structure. But the ultimate goal of representation is to, first of all, find out what the underlying causes of absences are for the student. And what we found is that our independence and that lawyer's independence makes a big difference in what families disclose, mm-hmm. such as I mentioned, this bullying or mental health involvement.
Yeah, and that's a big point. I don't want to leave that too quickly. It's one thing to be hauled into court in open court, even with a sympathetic judge, and the judge looking down at you from the bench and saying, "Why weren't you at school?" It's kind of hard to blurt out. It's because someone's raping me, or because I'm being bullied.
That's exactly right.
Those are very tough things to say.
Exactly
it's a very different environment if you have a good lawyer in a private environment who sits down and says, "I'm representing you, and that's my only job. And anything you tell me, I have to keep secret. Now, what's the real problem here, and how can I help you?" That's a very different environment, and I'm guessing that that's one of the main goals that you have for representation.
No, you're exactly right.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Dean Rivkin, who's a distinguished professor of law at the University of Tennessee College of Law. We're talking about how important it is to have legal representation during truancy hearings. After the break, we'll come back and talk about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll finish our discussion with Dean and with one of my students. Her name is Anna Swift. Stick around.
days, gold days, dear old golden rule days. Written and written and arithmetic, taught to the tune of a hickory stick. You were my queen in calico, I was your bashful barefoot beau, and you wrote on my slate, I love you, Joe.
Sean O'Brien, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Stuart Harris, one of the most important and least recognized days in American history is happening this week at Montpelier.
What is that?
It's called Constitution Day. It's
an important day.
It's not unlike Independence Day, but better.
It is much better.
Because Independence Day is the day that we thumped our chests and we said, look out, we're a country. But Constitution Day is the day we told people what kind of country we were going to
be. You know, I want to really emphasize that. I want to emphasize that. And I want to give people a current example. They've had a revolution in Egypt. And that was great. That's fantastic. Down with the tyrant. But they've yet to have their own real Constitution Day there.
Right.
They've yet to really establish a workable, widely accepted, ratified constitution that people are actually going to obey. And that's what happens when you don't have a constitution, when you don't have a consensus on a form of government. This really is our birthday. This is really when we said we are this kind of nation.
You're absolutely right. So September 17th, 1787,
yep,
is the day that the members of the Constitutional Convention signed off on the Constitution and sent it out to the states for ratification. So we celebrate this day at Montpelier. We love this day. It's one of the most important days in really world history. It's kind of called the hinge point in world
Akil Amar. He thinks it is like the single most important thing in all of like human history.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, we also do a big celebration for Constitution Day, but because it's happening on a weekday this year, we're going to celebrate it on September 21st with a big festival and fireworks and a wine festival.
So we will talk about that later, but I'd like to talk about the overlooked actual weekday. And so, you know, that would be a cool thing to do, to come on the actual day on September 17th. You'll be open, right?
We'll be open. And, of course, one of the most important things to remember is the prep work, the work that sort of established what the Constitution was going to be, happened at Montpelier. You can go to James Madison's, what we refer to as the old library or the upstairs library, and stand in the room where he was preparing for the Constitutional Convention. He was reading the 200 books that he had Jefferson send to him from France. He was writing documents and thinking about things and writing letters to important people like George Washington and saying, we have a really important job in front of us. And you can go in there and you can sort of absorb that moment on Constitution Day. It's very powerful, and
the simple fact is that since it's a weekday, the chances are it's not going to be big crowds.
It's going to be.
I hesitate to use this word, but it's almost a holy experience to go. I mean, that has to be my favorite place in all of Montpelier is that second floor library.
Jack Rakove, when he visited that room, Jack Rakove is the world-renowned constitutional scholar from Stanford.
Right.
When he was in that room, people were talking, and he just said, wait a minute, please, everybody just be quiet. I just want to be in this room quiet for a minute.
And on this September 17th, you can do that.
You can do that.
You can think about that.
Please come visit us.
Maybe I'll have to do it. In fact, I want to do it.
I'll give you a special tour.
Thank you very much, Sean.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Now let's finish our discussion with Dean Rivkin and Anna Swift of the University of Tennessee College of Law, all about the importance of representation and protection of constitutional rights in truancy proceedings.
And one of the things that lawyers can bring to the table is they can, for example, go to the local mental health facility and get the student's, his client's records or her client's records and read the diagnoses, which is something that doesn't necessarily translate with a lot of families. They know that there are issues. They know that there is a local mental health agency worker who is involved with their child. They may think it's ADHD. They may think it's something a little different. But they're not looking at a diagnosis that says depression. They're not looking at a diagnosis that that most people really understand. A lawyer can understand it, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what lawyers can bring to the table. Once it's understood, then the real job is developing with the school system's involvement and pushing the school system to develop the kind of alternative program for this student that will get him or her back. And there are lots of ways of thinking of that. That's the ultimate goal of representation. And that's where pro bono lawyers, lawyers who look, you know, who could fulfill their pro bono commitment with this kind of work, that's where they would be terrific. Mm-hmm.
And just to illustrate the importance of a lawyer's role in a student who's charged with truancy in their life, we just recently expunged at least three different clients' records, which was a very high, pivotal moment of success for those students.
Okay, now that's another thing. That's great, and I want to hear all about that, but that's actually something I forgot to ask about. Isn't that another negative of these truancy courts is that you get a record? And then this record follows you around, and if you're applying to college later, I mean, if you turn your life around or maybe a problem for a job, is that going to hurt you?
It can. And once again, on the books, it says that these records shouldn't follow you. But when an employer says, have you ever been to juvenile court? Yeah. Have you ever been, you know, where when you
were
there?
Yeah, what are you supposed to do, lie?
Not supposed to lie,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So a kid who's honest about having been to truancy court six times can find himself not able to find a job.
Very possibly.
Okay.
Right?
So that was, I'm going to go back to Anna. Mm-hmm. So you were able to find somebody who's able to get some of these records expunged.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We did it.
Yes.
Anna did it.
Mm-hmm. We had several clients who had been involved in the truancy court for many years, and the real underlying issue was that these clients were experiencing mental health issues, but the schools still, you know, had the petitions filed, and these students ended up in truancy court. But once we were appointed to their cases by the judge, you know, we were able to help the school system identify the causes and get these students alternative education programs so that by the time these students were seniors, they graduated from high school. And right now, today, they are attending college. They are getting degrees. You know, so they've made these impressive turnarounds, and if they didn't have the help of our legal counsel, who really knows where they would be today?
An idea. And you actually did that, you yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Rifkin.
Anna drafted, helped us draft the petitions, and mm-hmm. And the judge readily signed them, and which is good.
Tremendous.
The expunction motions.
But not every, we're only representing, obviously, a relatively few number of students.
Right here in Knoxville.
Here in Knoxville.
I imagine so.
And there are 9,600 truancy petitions, or there were, filed in 2012, which was up from 9,000 in 2011. Mm-hmm. These cases are brought all around the state. They're brought all around the country. Texas, for example, which has been in the paper recently for filing upwards of over 100,000 truancy cases against students, you know, as a problem that's been really out of control and that has constitutional infirmities all over the place in terms of the way they do their truancy prosecutions. And a very recent complaint by public interest groups in Tennessee were filed against some of the Dallas area school systems for discriminating against students with disabilities, for the racial disproportionality there of the number of students who were hauled into juvenile court for truancy, mm-hmm. For the constitutional due process kind of violations that we are litigating in our cases. This is a big national issue today. The state of Rhode Island, the state of West Virginia, the state of Washington, there have been cases popping up over only in recent years, actually. Very little truancy litigation, systemic truancy litigation before that. So there's a lot of meat for lawyers to get into if they
True.
Take their...
And for students, obviously.
And for students.
And for students. In fact, I'm going to shift focus just slightly and talk about the educational aspect of this. Young Anna Swift here was just in my constitutional law class this summer and had very good class participation, asked very good questions. And for a person who is not the most outspoken, I think, she contributed greatly to class. And so now I want to ask you, both of you, what are the educational advantages? What do you learn in this practicum?
Where to start? I was just speaking with Professor Rivkin's wife the other day, who is an integral part of this practicum.
And who is she?
On a pro bono basis. Her name is Brenda McGee.
Right.
She's been a long time now retired, except brought back on a pro bono basis, special education lawyer. She knows that field very well. And a lot of the cases we have had special education implications. So that's who Brenda is, and she, you know, works with the practicum on that basis.
And so what is your involvement other than drafting things? What else do you learn in that?
Well, I was just commenting to her that throughout my law school education, I had gotten so used to just attending class, lecture-style classes, you know, reading the casebook, preparing for finals. And all of a sudden, because of my work with this practicum, I have three clients, you know, and I'm actually meeting with these clients, and I'm responsible for calling them to update them on their cases or to see if they have any questions. And that's a very different experience from what I'm used to with lecture-style classes. It really makes the experience a lot more personal. I'm starting, I think, to learn what it will take to be a good lawyer, you know.
It's been said it takes about 10 years to become a good lawyer, and the first three of them are in law school, and I think that's probably a conservative estimate. Maybe it might take closer to 20 or so before you really know what you're doing. But you're well on your way, and that's very good. But I'm just curious. Now, what makes you so interested in these particular issues? If I may say so, you don't look like somebody who had a lot of truancy issues in her youth.
I can't say that I've ever been truant. But the way that I view juveniles, kids, students in the truancy or juvenile system, I strongly feel that these students are the most vulnerable members of our society. Certainly the elderly or someone with a mental illness would be considered a vulnerable member of our society, but I think children in particular really need this help, and they need help with navigating through the legal system. So I feel, you know, I guess a lot of compassion toward them.
And compassion? Idealism? What is all this stuff? I thought all the law students these days just wanted to make lots of money.
Some certainly do.
This course officially is called Public Interest Law and Lawyering. We call it the Education Law Practicum. And we have 10 students each year. Course like this, you need to limit the number of students because of the intensive supervision and work that's associated with it. But every single one of our classes of law students in this course, all 40 students over 4 years, like Anna, have a public interest perspective on what law should be, what they want to do with law. And that's one of the aspects of the course that we really try to emphasize. We try to connect individual representation with changing systems for the benefit of vulnerable, in this instance, kids.
Well, Dean, I know you've written extensively on all kinds of public interest law. What in particular drew you to this particular problem?
What drew us to this problem was the district attorney here in Knoxville, a very broad-minded, fair-minded man who met with us about 4 years ago. And we had known him before because he knew that we had done education work in the past. He asked us if we would consider getting involved with some of these cases to see what legal issues were there. And we agreed to do it. I agreed to do it, and I set up this course. It seemed like a nice niche course. I never realized the full scope of the issues, but because of our work in representing students in education matters, special ed, school discipline, and the like, we felt as if, you know, we knew a big chunk of this. And we did it. And 4 years later, we have, I think, pretty much gotten a good handle on what's going on and what should be going on. We took on different aspects of the system the more we learned about it. For example, the state of Tennessee did not have a statewide set of regulations directing what school systems should do before students are prosecuted for truancy, before they file a petition. So with our practicum class of 2 years ago, we got on the agenda of the Tennessee State Board of Education, which is the body here that does rules, and we urged them to develop a set of rules that would be statewide and consistent and fair to parents and students. And just last week, it was a year and a half enterprise. Just last week, we succeeded in having the board do that. The general counsel.
So they just adopted those regulations?
Just last week.
Well,
right.
Congratulations. Yeah. That's quite an accomplishment.
It was a really nice campaign.
Yeah.
And the students should get most of the credit, along with the general counsel of the Tennessee State Board of Education, who recognized the need for this statewide and convinced the board itself.
It sounds like you're doing lots of very good work. It sounds like there's progress being made, not just here, but in other states, and I congratulate you on that. But I sense that there is also an immediate need. And so for all those lawyers out there who might be interested in this and who might want to volunteer, especially those who are in Tennessee and even more specifically in or around Knoxville, what do they need to do? Whom do they contact? How do they get involved?
They should contact me.
Okay, and how do we do that?
We do that through the University of Tennessee College of Law website.
Right. And that's simply
where my email is.
Law.utk.edu.
Correct.
Right? And law.utk.edu. And also, what is your email address?
It's drivkin, D-R-I-V-K-I-N, at utk.edu.
D-R-I-V-K-I-N at utk.edu. Well, Anna Swift and Dean Rivkin of the University of Tennessee College of Law, thank you for being on your weekly Constitutional.
Thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, baby, I may be a fool, wasting my time by going to school. The way you got me, loving you so, I can't do my homework anymore. I can't do my homework anymore. Oh, baby, you got me so blind. I'm walking around in circles, about to lose my mind. The way you got me, loving you so, I can't do my homework anymore.
But wasn't that just an inspiring conversation? You know, lawyers get criticized a lot, but lawyers also do a lot of good things, and Dean and Anna really represent the highest traditions of the legal profession, so thanks to both of them for being on the show. I really appreciate it. And you lawyers out there, you get involved. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.